Welcome back to the WRN podcast, and I have another fabulous guest today. Do you want to introduce yourself?
Hey up, I'm Louise Distress from Wakefield.
And are you still in Wakefield?
Near Wakefield. I feel like I'm in witness protection at the moment, to be honest. I'm in hiding.
And you grew up in Wakefield, West Yorkshire?
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Anyone who's not familiar with Wakefield, it's famous for three things. Jay McDonald, Viagra Do song, and rhubarb.
You're probably gonna have to explain the rhubarb bit.
It's part of what's called the rhubarb triangle. So I think a lot of pies get made around it.
You've got to add a lot of sugar to rhubarb to make that work well in a pie, I find.
Yeah.
I don't think there'll be too many people realise there's a rhubarb triangle in Yorkshire.
Yeah.
If you don't learn anything else new in this podcast, and you will, you now know there's a rhubarb triangle in Yorkshire.
Yeah, and there's also a pie shop in Wakefield as well, so you can go for a bit of rhubarb and go for a bit of pie and then go down Coal Mining Museum, you know.
Excellent. Day out in Wakey.
Yeah, do the agadoo down Wakefield Westgate.
So growing up in Wakefield, what kind of music did you get to listen to? What's influenced you over the years?
Well, going right back to the start, growing up in Wakefield, I had a bloody horrible childhood, and I was psychologically and physically abused by my mother, and it was escaping into the music and the poetry and the songwriting. That's what got me through those times, and still what gets me through. It's all I had, and so when I was 16, I decided I'd be better off on the streets than being at home. So I ran away, and I spent many years sleeping rough and finding myself in dodgy situations with dangerous blokes who basically took advantage of me. And I had no money, I had no place to go, and I just travelled from place to place, gig to gig, with this like mad blind belief that whenever I got to wherever I was going, I'd eventually be taken care of. But now looking back, I can see that made me extremely vulnerable and wide open to exploitation and becoming preyed upon. So I've got a lot of stories, and which I put into my music. You know, my music is all real life stories about me and my life. And but one positive thing about growing up and about my mum is that she had a really, really good taste in music. So I grew up on all the fab stuff, you know, like stuff like Bee Gees and ELO, Queen, Dionne Warwick. God, I love Dionne Warwick. Whitney Houston, like loads of disco and Motown. And what changed it all for me was hearing Nirvana's first album, Bleach, for the very first time. And that was a friend at school made me a mixtape, and it was on there. And Kurt Cobain's the whole reason I wanted to pick up a guitar, and I did, and I learned to play guitar by bunking off school and smoking and misbehaving and listening to this angry punk rock freedom music. So that's kind of my background, really.
So you taught yourself guitar?
Yeah. It's Well, there's this thing, and it's called a power chord. And once you learn the chord shape with your first finger and your two, I don't even know what they call it, your first and your fourth and fifth, whatever. It's just this shape. And once you master how to play that power chord, you can play like a really rudimentary, basic version of pretty much any song that there is going. And like, and all Nirvana songs are like done with these power chords on the guitar. So yes, yeah, so I was a bit of a power chord princess when I started out.
I like that, power chord princess.
Yeah.
So when did you write your first song?
Well, when I was a teenager, my first ever gig in a band was in this grotty little pub in Wakefield called Tut and Shive. And me and my mates were only in there because they served underage kids, so we could buy cheap lager.
Are they still going? Are you going to be in bother for telling them?
No. They shut down years ago. It's been bulldozed now. Probably a good thing. But, yeah, God, it were right diving. I remember though, this cover band playing, and me and my mates were like, yeah, we're in a band. And they went, go on then, play us a song. So we got up and did a song. Oh, it was dreadful. And, you know, so I was writing and playing, you know, from a really early age. I mean, I wasn't any good. I mean, I'm still not any good. But, you know, it's something that I've always done. It's just something that it's like breathing to me. I've always done it, you know, and I don't know why. And I just try not to question it too much because it can give it that analysis paralysis thing.
Yeah.
It's like, it's just this thing. I just love it. It's who I am. It's what I do. Yeah.
So you clearly had that latent talent. you took a very circuitous route to bring it out. Does it feel sometimes like you can just almost pick up any guitar and just make a start with a song? Do you start with the guitar? Do you start with the words in your head? Or do you wake up in the morning with a melody?
It comes to me in all different kinds of ways, but at the root of it, I would say that the freedom to express myself relies on the ability to feel my own feelings, and that's something that is at threat in this current climate that we're all living in. Mm. And I've said it for many years that, you know, I feel like artists, proper artists, I feel like they're kind of viewed as being like terrorists nowadays, you know? So it's kind of, it's evolved, my relationship with it has evolved over time, you know, and it is under great strain at the moment. But I mean, I think back in the early days when I started performing, you know, I was playing my first gigs in, you know, pubs and open mic nights, just got a little dive bars. I just, you know, and at that point in my life, when I was younger, I had my mind blinders on, and I had a big chip on my shoulder because of what happened to me as a kid. And I spent a lot of my time kind of pointing the finger and screaming, you know, oh, here's what's wrong with the world. It's the world's fault. It's the world that's doing it to me. And that was what was expressed in my first album, Dreams from the Factory Floor. I put that out myself in 2013 and basically dragged a suitcase around on Megabus and sold the CDs out the suitcase kind of thing. But then it got a proper worldwide release in 2015. And then earlier this year, I released my second album, Beauty After Bruises. And I just say, I think the major difference between that first album and this new one, at least in an emotional sense, it's like, it feels like growing up. It's like a big shift in perspective. And I got to a point where I was like, hang on a minute, you know, well, the way that I see the world, it's actually because of the way that I see myself. And if I carry around these bricks from my past any longer, I'm going to end up building the same house. So I've got to get out my own way, really. And then going back to the relationship with the where everything starts with being able to feel my own feelings. When I came back to the music, when I came back to music around this time last year, I promised myself that I wouldn't self-censor because I was self-censoring massively, and I never stood up for myself, and it really did a lot of damage to me. Inside myself, in terms of my relationship with myself. So I said, well, you know, I'm going to honor the parts of myself that I look away from. And um, And then ever since, I feel like my life has been just one big long cancellation, and I don't really consider myself as actually having a career anymore. It's more like a vendetta at this point, I think.
And when it comes to being a musician, you need to have that ability to express yourself, to be creative. Yeah. And as you said, your music has matured over the years. Yeah. As you as a person have gone through all that you've gone through. I think I can understand how hearing Nirvana and Kurt Cobain for the first time could really hit home. The first time I heard Nirvana, it was the pain that I could hear that came through, as well as just bloody loving the guitar. And there's something about music expressing what words on their own can't. And you need to be able to do both.
Yeah. It was a similar thing for me when I first heard Nirvana, in that I remember thinking to myself, this sounds like how I feel. And I'm not the only one that feels this way. And there was a lot of power in that. And Kurt Cobain was, he was profound in his lyrics and in his melodies and in the things that he had to say. And he wasn't like a trained guitarist or, you know, he wasn't like professional. He was just self-taught. And he said something like, if it doesn't matter if it's sloppy, as long as it has passion and as long as it's true.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something that's always stayed with me. So I think the revelation I had about the promise I made to myself about not self-censoring and about celebrating the parts of myself I looked away from, the ugly parts, the shadow aspects of myself. The ugly truth, that's something I think that's, you know, not trying to be perfect. You know, that's a thing that I think stayed with me right from the beginning up until now. It's like an angel on my shoulder, you know.
I think music is a conversation, and it's one that happens over time and space. Yeah. I could be listening to, they could be a long dead artist or composer, but their music's still with us, and I can listen to it, and they're talking to me, they're telling me something.
Yeah.
And I have a response to that music. And to me, that's a conversation, but it only works if the music talks to you in the first place. And you can't have a music industry without creativity and free expression. And nobody will listen to anything created over the decades. It will soon disappear. If it's just generic, formulaic, industry-friendly created music, rather than truly coming from the heart and soul and brains of and the creativity of the musicians.
Yeah. Yeah. The soul is, for me, the most important aspect of that. And when I chat with people about music, I often ask them the question, which is, when was the last time you heard a song that made you stop dead in your tracks? And people just can't answer that question anymore. They always seem to go back to something from their childhood, something that means something to them, but something that soundtracked their life in a really profound way. Like, you know, in like what Nirvana did for me when I was growing up.
Yeah.
It never seems to be anything that's current that's been heard on TikTok, for example.
Quite. I do wonder, I mean, I'm going to show my age here, but so I was brought up as well listening to some great music. It was Queen, ABBA, Dusty Springfield,
oh, yeah.
Roy Orbison. I mean, some great voices in there too, and great melodies and amazing pop and rock.
Mm.
But then as a teenager, the one that really hit me sideways, didn't see it coming, was the Smiths.
Oh.
Morrissey's voice and Mars guitar. And I just think now, as you've just said, teenagers, 13, 14, do they get that? Does that happen to them? Like, that happened to me with the Smiths. It happened to you with Nirvana. Does that even exist anymore?
I mean, when I used to be on tour all the time, and I was chatting with people who come to my gigs after the show, I always used to ask them. I used to say, you know, what are you listening to at the moment? And if they had kids, I'd say, well, what are your kids listening to at the moment? And I'd go check it out. And so I would just kind of, try and go off that, really. But I will say that I'm struggling to think of an example. But I mean, it's got to be out there. I mean, you know,
well, there's yourself for starters. So there clearly is some good stuff out there.
Thank you.
I think it's finding it in the world of music streaming as well, rather than sitting down to record the top 40 on Radio 1 with your tape, trying to press stop before the DJ speaks.
I mean, it's been really interesting, and I think serendipitous. Because I'm a big believer in serendipity, you see. Now, I mean, it, you know, it's just gone past the 10-year anniversary of me self-releasing Dreams from a Factory Floor and going out on my finger-pointing Megabus mission and selling CDs of that album out in my suitcase, you know. And one of the songs on that album that means the most to me, which is called The Hand You Hold.
Mm-hmm.
It's been really interesting to see how people have connected with that song. The song was written, you know, I was expressing exactly what I'm expressing now. But I think maybe the compass was pointed just ever so slightly in the wrong direction.
There are often songs that artists have which they are most proud of or mean the most to them.
Well, at one of my first ever gigs, it was like a workers' festival, like this crappy workers' festival thing in Sheffield. And I met Anne Scargill, and she taught me a lot about how the miners' strike changed things for women in the 80s. I mean, it's before my time, but, you know, she told me about how women found their voices and gained experience, you know, organising pickets and rallies and soup kitchens. And I see the same thing happening now in what we're all doing.
Mm-hmm.
And she told me some really funny stories about how, you know, the husbands would say, oh, come on, I want my wife back, get me some tea, you know. But then the women would reply, oh, piss off and get it yourself, you know. So it changed everything. And she sang me this song called Women of the Working Class, and she said, it's really important for women to have their songs.
Mm.
And she said, you know, you must write a song that's just for women. So that's what I did. And I went away and I thought about it and I wrote The Hand You Hold. And then I released that song on International Women's Day in 2012. It was my first ever single.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the song that I'm the most proud of, because I started out as I Meant to Go On. And I think the chorus, never let the hand you hold hold you down, I think it just says it all, really. And so 10 years later, almost to the day, you know, since that album was released, you know, I've always had a lot to say about my experience as a woman, women's rights and freedom of speech. So I'm not entirely sure why my so-called controversial views have come as a shock to some people.
Because you were meant to have changed them. You meant to have moved on and progressed and be more inclusive, Louise.
Well, it's like, you know, on my new album, there's this song called Girl in the Mirror, and radio won't touch it because they said it were offensive. And I'm like, and I'm just like, yeah, but them in the mirror don't quite have the same ring to it, does it? But I'll tell you what I find really shocking is that like people think that I give a shit about what they think of me. Like, I've never cared what people think, so I'm not going to start now. I'm offended by how offended they are. I'm mm-hmm. offended by their offendedness.
Mm-hmm.
yeah, it's trippy. It's really trippy. But to see that song resonating so wildly with really the women that I wrote it for, it's been amazing. It's been absolutely amazing.
So at the moment you're not touring, you're not gigging, but at the time when you wrote that song, you had success with it. You were gigging. You were going around the country, whether it was under your own steam or. You said it then went to worldwide release in 2015. Did you get some more support from the music industry then, or have you always had to do things under your own steam?
Well, I mean, I guess, you know, success is subjective, innit? But for me, I think what I viewed as success at the time, and I suppose still do, is that, you know, I was just really proud of the fact that I was taking charge of my own ideas and my own creativity,
mm-hmm.
and I was coming to the table on my own terms. I've always viewed myself as a bit of an outsider from the music industry. I don't really feel like I'm a part of it, although I have been affected by it massively. Right. You know, and I was doing my thing. I was touring all over. I went to America, Canada, Scandinavia, mm-hmm. All over Europe. I had my stuff played on radio. I got to support, you know, loads of big bands from the punk scene, you know, all those old punk heroes, stuff like that. But, you know, I have to be honest and say that the whole time I always just felt like an outsider, and like I wasn't really I hadn't found my tribe yet.
Okay.
Uh-huh. Is what I'm trying to say. And, yeah, I mean, you know, a label in America saw what was happening and they said, well, why don't we do it, you know, as a worldwide release on vinyl sort of thing, blah, blah, blah. But no, they didn't support me. They just ripped me off and I never got paid a penny for that.
Right.
So, it's just been swings and roundabouts. It's like I've done, you know, I think I've done some cool stuff and I'm really proud of it, because I would have, considering, you know, the fact that, you know, my background and where I come from, and I've been told that I'm a piece of shit all my life and that I've done everything I wanted to do and all the things that I was told that I would never do, you know, and I've done it on my own terms. It's something to be really proud of, I think. But there has been, you know, I've got my fair share of horror stories, you know, from along the way. It's certainly not been easy, you know, but then I kind of have to tell myself, well, that there's a lot worse things than and a lot harder things in life than being an artist and being a musician. I mean, you know, it's not like I'm a brain surgeon and one wrong move could end someone's life. You know what I'm saying? It's, yeah, I don't know. I'm overwhelming myself again, I think.
Are you still writing songs?
I've got a whole new album written, and I've got the demos recorded in my phone, and I've got a title and everything. And I'm really, really excited about these songs. I wrote them when I was going through the cancellations. I would like to record them at some point and see about getting that new album out.
That would be fabulous. I'm sure you'd have lots of interest and support. What did get you cancelled?
I don't even know where to start. It's like if I had a quid for every time someone slagged me off on the internet, like, I wouldn't even be here talking to you.
You'd be off on your island.
I would.
Your own little turf island.
Yeah, I would. And what I'd do is I'd go down the adoption shelter and I'd just adopt like 100 dogs and horses and cats, right? And
I'd that one. Yep.
Yeah, and I'd take my Noah's Ark and I'd just piss off to my desert island and drink pina coladas all day and stroke my dogs. Like, that's the idea of, like, that's success to me, you know, to get to that point where I can go, oh, they've all finally pissed off and left me alone. But I think, like, the thing that really, I think, was a huge catalyst for me, and this is a really, it's really important for me to express this, is like, so like years back, you know, I played the women's stage at Manchester Pride Festival,
mm-hmm.
years and years ago, and had always been very supportive, you know, I don't like saying the word community, but you know what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
But then, like, this thing happened in November 21, and my ex-guitarist, man in a dress, boyfriend, basically, they made up a load of crap about me, and they posted it all on social media, and they were bragging, oh, we're going to report it to police. We're going to report it to police. And they did. They reported me to the police. For transphobic hate crime, bearing in mind, like, I'd never met my ex-guitarist's man in a dress boyfriend or spoken to him in my entire life. And anyway, the police investigated it for a few months, but they couldn't find any proof of anything. So the whole thing got dropped. And then in the end, the police actually, they told them to leave me alone.
Mm-hmm.
And then later on, I found out that this man in a dress had, like, been in prison for attempted murder, and he's in the Daily Mail. There's a story about him in the Daily Mail where he's been banned from playing women's football, and there's a load of other awful stuff as well. But that's when it's when the penny first dropped for me, and I realised, hang on a minute, I think the LGBT has been hijacked by the T here, and that's where I changed my mind. And again, going back to the promise I made to myself to not self-censor, because mm-hmm. when this happened, when I got reported to the police and all this stuff went up on social media, I never stood up for myself. I never said anything about it. I never defended myself, because I was just so spun out by what was happening. I just couldn't make any sense of it at the time. And I was scared, you know, I was really scared, because it's like, you know, being labelled a transphobe just because someone says you are, and it's like, it's scary, you know.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I digress. But when I came back to the music industry around this time last year, I was like, okay, I'm not going to self-censor. So I started sharing my views about, but more directly than before, like, about free speech and about cancel culture. I just said, look, cancel culture, it's It's like it feels like it's mind games for middle classes. The social media feels like it's the toilet of the internet. And then I said something I think cancel culture is a bigger problem than global warming, because if I can't be myself, what's the fucking point? You know, I might. And then if anybody gave me any shit, you know, I was like, right, I'm going to stand up for myself this time.
Mm-hmm.
And then over time, I realised it's now become impossible for me to speak about my life or my music without first talking about being a woman. Everything starts with me being a woman. And my music's about my human condition, and that's my adult human female condition. It's just a no-brainer for me. And when I started speaking directly about this, I was just immediately met with this avalanche of abuse and threats to my safety, and people saying all kinds of horrible stuff, calling me all kinds of names. And then I asked my booking agency, I went, look, you know, I've got to play some gigs to promote my new album. You know, can you have a word with the venues and put some safety measures in place to keep me safe? You know, the police are involved. I've got to go to court, get restraining orders, injunctions, things like that. And they responded by sending me this horrible email with a bunch of links to educate me on why cancel culture is really positive, that there's no such thing as cancel culture. It's called being accountable for your actions. And then they said to me, the exact words were, if you continue to publicly deny that trans women are women, your position will have detrimental effects on your musical career. So this is why I say I don't really feel like I have a career anymore. It's a vendetta. You know, that's been just a couple of recent examples over the past few years. But in a way, because I've lost count of how many times people have come after me, it has given me a thick skin. And so the stuff that's really bothering me is actually a bit closer to home, because, as I said, I'm dealing with a police investigation where I'm the victim of a crime, and the perps are pulling out all the stops to keep me quiet. So I'm not going to go into too much detail about that, because I don't want to jeopardise that investigation. In any way. But what I can say is that not being able to talk about what's happening to me is really traumatic, and it's really painful, and it has put me in a dark place. I mean, you know, I wanted to come on this podcast today, and it means so much to me to be a guest on here, and I really wanted to show up and be the most stunning and brave, best version of myself ever. But like, I just feel like a total dumpster fire at the moment, and and I can't talk about it. And especially, you know, when I care about freedom of speech so much, it just does feel like some sort of psychological warfare, and I need to be able to let my anger out, and I need to let my grief breathe, and it's not an easy thing to do in the first place, as I said, because we need to be able to have that ability to feel our own feelings and express our emotions. And it's a very painful thing to come alive and start healing from this sort of stuff. And you know, but then it's like, then on the flip side, it's like, since the Daily Mail thing, there's just been so much bloody support for me. And I know, for the first time in my life, I know I'm not alone in what I'm experiencing, and that my story is just one of many. So in a strange way, and in a tragic way, it does give me a great sense of comfort. But, you know, this is the world we live in now. Cancel culture, it's real. It is. And we should be able to speak about our own lives and our own work without the fear of being threatened and the loss of livelihood. And we need to be able to fight for the freedom to speak about these things and to be able to defend ourselves from these attacks and this slander and defamation. And I think in my case, you know, especially if we're the victim of a crime as well. Mm. So there's a lot to unpack, really.
Would the teenage Louise be quite surprised to hear that the older Louise ended up in the Daily Mail? amazing what criticism you get just for being in that paper, as if you were ever going to be spoken about or print, had your story printed in The Guardian.
I think that teenage me would go, fuck's it. I ran away from home and I thought I'd left all this shit behind.
Uh-huh.
But the same dynamic is playing itself out over and over and over again. And it's really interesting that many of the women that I've had conversations with about this have also been through similar experiences where they find that actually this dynamic, this narky scapegoating dynamic, it's not new to them. You know, they're being the black sheep of the family or labelled a witch or being problematic. It's also been a recurring theme for them as well. And I find that very interesting, and it's something that I want to explore more. I think it's like archetypal territory, really. I mean, it's very Jungian, you know. but then again, there's that thing, like, you know, history is a wheel that keeps on spinning and all that, and there's loads of us throughout history. You know, it's even back to like Greek mythology, and you know, but I'm saying this now, but what I've got in my head is I'm just actually really proud to be part of this great tradition of being problematic. It's great.
So you should be.
So, yeah. So I think looking, this is really cheesy saying, but I think like looking back as a teenager, I think I'd be like me looking back on myself as a teenager, like the flip side of it, I'd be like, I really feel like I'm actually now being the person that I needed when I was growing up.
Uh-huh.
You know, because I never had anybody. I never knew what it was like to be listened to or supported or protected in any way. And that's what left me open to gave me vulnerabilities, that left me open to being exploited and being perfect cult cannon fodder. You know, so interesting question. Very psychological. Very Jungian. I like it.
What do you think we can do as in the Women's Rights Network, women coming together in other groups, what men could be doing to try and get our freedom of expression back and our rights back? And more.
I think that the first step is for more women to come forward courageously and without apology. And I feel that women need to know that and see that, you know, yes, there's been so much support for me and there will be for them too. I just think they might need to just sort of be pointed in the right direction of kind of where to go for that support. I do think that we need to, build essentially a new industry for women artists like me.
Mm-hmm.
We need a proper counterculture where women actually do have a proper say. But that does start with more of us coming forward and not apologising. Don't ever back down to the mob. I think if I was to try and point anyone in the right direction, I think that I would first recommend for them to sign up with Women's Rights Network. That was one of the first resources that I reached out to when I was questioning what was happening. And I was really scared at the time. I never thought that a year later I'd be here chatting to you on this podcast. It's mad. And then also becoming a member of the Free Speech Union as well.
Yeah.
I'm a member of the Free Speech Union, and so should anybody else who's got anybody who's worried about losing their job and having their being censored anyway. Definitely join the Free Speech Union. They've been really great for me. They've been really supportive, and being a rock. And then but I would say, like, you know, for any women artists, so Rosie Kay and Denise Fahmy, they're launching a new organisation called Freedom of the Arts. I think that's coming in the autumn. So I would say definitely check that out, because there's going to be a lot of resources and, you know, more support available to us there. But and also, you know, I always say to women, I say, look, you know, my DMs, I know it's cheesy, but my DMs are open, but they are, you know, anybody can message me anytime. I think it's really important to for me to try and support as many women as possible in the same way that I've been supported as well, you know, by yourselves. And Birdie Rose has been a really big support for me. She was one of the first people that reached out to me, and she supported me through my whole, we called it my turf out, my coming out. And, you know, she was such a rock. She was there on the phone and we were talking on WhatsApp, and, you know, and she was pumping me up, giving me a lot of energy, you know. It makes a big difference, like, to be able to... Sorry, I'll just rewind a little bit, but it's like, because Birdie comes from a similar background to me. So, like, we were talking to each other, and so many times we were like, oh my God, like, and pennies just dropping, and we're going, oh, we've got like these stories that are like, so it's like we've had like parallel lives, you know, running alongside each other, and it's all the same stuff. And hearing someone go, oh my God, that happened to me as well. When I thought that I was on my own and it was just me that was going, I was defective and there was something wrong with me. I was like, whoa, it's just not just me.
No, it's definitely not just you. Birdie did some excellent artwork. Really talented.
Oh, yeah. 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 We're actually working on a little project together. So I'm hoping to get that up and running before the end of the month.
Oh, exciting. So, okay.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, you know what? Because turf is the new punk. That's why.
Love it.
We're all punks.
And I do think this is how it's going to have to go. I think you're right. It's counterculture. It's probably having to start over in lots of cases. I think the old institutions, the old ways of working, I think we've lost a lot of them. And we are just going to have to start over, which is bloody frustrating, because, you know, women were doing that in the, well, since forever, but, you know, modern history, 50s, 60s, 70s, the second wave of feminism that so many women were involved in, US, UK, Western Europe, so on, and starting the rape crisis centres from scratch. There was no government funding. There was, you know, that was, women did that on their own. Their own arts organisations, their own sports organisations, all of that. And, of course, it's been taken over.
Yeah.
What do you do when something has been completely and utterly taken over? Do you try and fight to get it back, or do you start over? And I thought we could probably get some of it back, but now I'm moving more toward, we're probably just going to have to start over. What do you think?
Yeah, I've had those conversations as well. And every single time, it's the conclusion that we've come to and that I've come to is burn it all down and start again.
rebuild. And then I remember Heather, the WRN founder, saying that we women had taken our eye off the ball. We thought we'd actually achieved quite a lot, and we had, still nowhere near everything, but that we took our eye off the ball. And that is something that can't ever happen ever again. So if we build new things, we have to really hold on to them tight.
Yeah, yeah. I feel like what we're dealing with is, it's well, as women and as women with in whatever our roles and our jobs are and our artistic mediums, I feel like that we're fighting two existential battles here, you know, which is one as women, and then for me, I'm also fighting one as an artist as well. I think that, and this includes men as well, is that this thing for me, I see it like, I just think it's just so like Lord of the Flies. And I feel like it's not a case of, it's really Lord of the Flies, and it's reached a point where it's a case of, it's not if they come for you, it's when. And my experience tells me, because I said, you know, I've really lost count of how many times people have come after me. It's not even the case that I've done anything in particular. Like, they don't need a reason. They'll just decide, well, we just don't like it. So they will, if they don't have a reason, they'll just invent one anyway. So it's a case of, it's not if, it's when. And and I think that we need, I do think that we need like a united front, you know, with our husbands and our brothers and the men in our lives. And I would love to see more men not be afraid to speak about this. And to say, have their say as well, because I know that the men in my life are also being greatly affected by this. And I'm not saying that, well, you know what I'm trying to say. It's just an observation. You know, they are being affected, but some of them feel like they don't really get a say in it. And it's having quite a damaging effect on, well, all of us, I think. Is this gender ideology? It's like it's a religion or something. You know?
And it's all pervasive. Yeah, absolutely.
It's having just such a parasitic effect on everybody, and it just contaminates every area of our lives, relationships, jobs, on so many levels, like physically, spiritually, emotionally, financially. And it's such a drain, like on the life force. It's making people sick.
Good point. I agree.
Yeah.
And I think that's why we need to be able to talk with each other, work together against it in networks like WRN, with the support of groups like FSU, and then those who are creative and in the arts, coming together, freedom of expression, and what you can do for those of us who aren't in the least bit creative is give us something worthwhile listening to, watching, reading. You know, it's actual art and not propaganda.
You know, the art versus propaganda, it's something that I think about all the time. And I observe a lot of women musicians. I mean, I'm loved to call them artists because they are propagandists, you know. But, you know, they're out there propagating the use of puberty blockers and the mutilation of children. And they're sending that message out to their young fans. And, you know, entertainment and music, it's like Kurt Cobain said it, he says it's like a fresh patch of grass for people to plant seeds in the minds of young people to promote basically child abuse amongst your fans, to your audience, and to be signposting them to you know, places like Stonewall and Mermaids. It's really scary, it's terrifying. And I often ask myself a question. I think, like, what is this person's line? When are they gonna, when is the penny gonna drop for them? What is it going to be that makes them actually say no? enough is enough? Is it going to be the loss of all the hard-earned rights that women have fought for? Is it going to be what I predict to be a suicide epidemic amongst young people? Is it going to be the fly lords coming after them and inventing a reason to go after them and they lose everything? What's their line? What is it? You know, because there's no escape from this. So it's hard to watch. It's really, really hard to watch. And especially in a you know, the thing that got me through as a kid and the thing that I love the most and the way that I express myself, you know, music and art, is now it's now propaganda, and it's being used as a weapon to inflict so much damage and trauma on people. That's a really hard thing to stand by and watch. And I can't stand by and watch it, you know. And I mean, and in terms of where can people find my stuff, it's like, this is the thing that always makes me laugh, because people will, you know, they'll say to me, oh, your music's shit. And it always makes me laugh, because I always think to myself, well, you know, art and music is subjective, but sex isn't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so so it's like, you can trash me all you want, but yeah, you know, I'm still a woman.
Quite, no matter what they think of your music, yeah. That is not changing. Well, yeah. I think your music is fabulous.
Thank you.
I love your voice. I really like the guttural, the fast guitar chord stuff. It's
yeah.
Great to drive to as well. Not speed. It's great to drive to. Love it.
That's cool.
The energy is just fantastic.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I really look forward to hearing that next album. Sounds like it's going to be great. For now, where can listeners go and buy your music, and where will they find you on social media?
I would say the easiest thing to do is just stick my name in Google and everything will come up, the good, the bad, the ugly, all the lies, the filth and the fury. Because there's actually only one of me. I'm the only Louise de Strasse, so I'm not hard to find, and that's a good thing, and it's also a bad thing. But yeah, stick my name in Google and have a game of cancellation bingo.
and buy your music.
Well, yeah, it might be something you like. But if people don't like it, that's all right as well. You know, we should be allowed to disagree, shouldn't we? You know,
we should. Although. Yeah. Fairly certain a significant number of listeners will. I think they will. Thank you so much for talking to us on the WRN podcast.
This dumpster fire is honoured and privileged to be a guest. It really means a lot to me. So thank you for having me. And if your lovely listeners have made it this far, we deserve a pat on the back.
I'm sure they have. Take care. Thank you.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in to the Women's Rights Network podcast. You can find all about the WRN over at womensrights.network. And if you would like to join us, womensrights.network/join-WRN.